The studio this week. Man, I am so excited. I've got a special guest this week. I got Joe Polina, who is the chief of police of the school district in San Bernardino County, California, one of the largest school district police in the entire country. And he's so graciously decided and also agreed to join us on Straight Talk on Leadership. We're going to talk about the Uvalde shooting. We're going to talk about school safety. And it's going to be really informative. So I can't wait for this episode. And as we always say, also Kelly's going to join us. And as we always say, sit back, turn up that volume, and get ready to change your life.
Hi, I'm Dean Crisp. Welcome to Straight Talk on Leadership. This is what we'd like to say is the no BS zone, where we give you leadership tips, ideas, and practical suggestions to help you become a top leadership performer. Our goal is simple: help you become the best version of yourself and reach your highest potential as a leader. So sit back, turn up the volume, get ready to change your life.
One. Hi, folks. As promised, Dean Crisp in the studio this week. Man, I'm on the road this week. I am actually in Jackson, Mississippi / Flowood, which is, if you don't know where Flowood would be, Jackson, Mississippi is the capital of Mississippi. I'm down there doing a master leader course, and I've been in the classroom all day, and it's been a great week down here with these folks in Mississippi. Love these folks down here. Love Chief Ricky McMillan, who's chief at the Flowood Police Department. It's always great to be back down here with these folks. But it's hot down here now. I'm going to tell you right now, it's 100 down here today. And humidity, woo, that was something else too. 80% humidity, about 100 degrees. Woo-wee, it was tough down here. But I'm joined this week with Kelly Corbin, who is always doing our podcast with us. She's also producing the podcast now. Kelly, I appreciate that. But I'm also joined with Joseph Polina, Joe Polino, my friend from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department. Joe, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right, Dean. Good to see you. I hope all is well with you, my friend.
Oh, yeah, man. Kelly, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's been a very busy day, but it's been a good day. And it's hot here in South Carolina, for sure. And Chief and I were talking about how hot it is in San Bernardino right now. So different kind of heat.
I believe it's hot all across the country. You know, they, what they say out there in California, they say, that's that dry heat. You know, I tell you what, 100 degrees is hot no matter where you are.
No doubt.
So, Kelly, tell the folks before we get started on the podcast what we got coming up. And we got a second book. I got another book or third or whatever you want to call it coming out. Man, that thing's coming out soon. But we want to remind you to pick up the book, Essential Leadership Lessons from the Thin Blue Line. But my next book's coming up, too. It's called Leadership Recipe. And really excited about that book coming up. So we got some classes coming up. Kelly, tell folks what's going on a little bit.
Well, you're going to Florida for a couple times in August. You'll be teaching Servant Officer down in Palm Beach and doing a special appearance for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And then we've got a couple of open enrollments, one in Titusville, Florida, over on the Space Coast. That also Servant Officer. We still have some seats open there. And then we're back in Oklahoma City again. Hey, Chief, you could actually fly to Oklahoma City from LA. I think there's no stops between those two, maybe. You can't get lucky. And we're doing intentional leadership there again right after the Labor Day holiday with our friends at the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics. And they're just a real good group of folks. We've got a lot of friends and supporters in the Oklahoma City area and also in California. We just haven't been out there in a while. So, but you can check our full schedule at our website, www.lhln.org. We have videos of Dean talking about what you get out of each of those classes. And there's information on how you can request to host a class or sign up for one that's on our schedule.
All right, Kelly, thank you very much. Now, Joe, so welcome to the show, man. And thank you so much. And instead of me trying to read a bio about you or whatever, just tell us briefly a little bit about you. And then I want you to talk about the San Bernardino County School District Police so that we get folks to introduce. Purpose of this podcast, to introduce people to school policing, talk a little bit about Uvalde and what happened there and what went wrong and what we can do to help stop that in the future. So, Joe, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Dean. And of course, you know, we met years ago with you facilitating in L.A. And it's been a blessing to have you as a friend. I know every so often we speak on the phone. And however, I started my law enforcement career in L.A., specifically of L.A. County Safety Police. And of course, the specific department I worked for did the Health Services Department. So all the big hub hospitals across MLA County, and we responded to when it was issued. And of course, I came out here 27 years ago. I was telling Kelly earlier before you came on. And of course, I've worked my way up from police officer all the way to chief. However, something exciting now for me these days is that I'm working on my PhD in Christian leadership. So of course, I'm doing a lot of reading, a lot of writing. So I applaud you on your second book.
That's great.
Of course, this is year 12, by the way, as chief, I think actually going into my 13th year. So it's been God's blessing to be able to lead that long, sir.
Well, Joe, I really appreciate you saying that. And you and I met actually when I was teaching for LEADA, and we were in the LEADA classes. I remember the class in L.A. that I was doing. I was staying in a hotel right downtown L.A. And they were actually filming one of the Pee Wee Herman movies when I was that was a long time ago. I think it's – and what was funny about that was, God, you remember I got sick as a dog that week. And I actually had to go to urgent care in downtown L.A. And if you ain't ever had an experience, go to urgent care in downtown L.A. and sit there with all the homeless people and all the other people. And L.A.'s got an eclectic, diverse population. And, it was right there near the Forum. The arena, the Forum, the downtown arena, the Staples Center or whatever that is. Yeah, the Staples Center. I think it was right across the street from the Staples Center. But anyway, I got sick that week. But I struggled, man, but I made it through. We made it through that week, but that was a really good week. And the reason I say that is not so much that what it say about me, but Joe is a absolute student of leadership and an absolute advocate of leadership. He has supported what we've done for many, many years. And he and I are personal friends. And I pick up the phone and call him. And when I thought about this Uvalde shooting and what's all that going on, man, I instantly thought, and Joe's got a lot to offer on that. So I'm glad to have you on the show here. And so, well, tell me a little bit about, and Kelly, and we'll introduce Kelly is, she's familiar to all of you on the show, but Kelly has also spent, I guess, God, Kelly, 12 years on the PTA.
Greenville County, South Carolina is, I believe, now the 49th largest school district in the country, and we're the largest in the state of South Carolina. And so there's about 80,000 students that populate the schools here in the county. And during the tenure that my children were involved, I have been a president of almost every one of their local PTAs and was president of the state of South Carolina PTA's District 1, which is Greenville County. So that was a pretty big deal. Was actually on the board and president when Sandy Hook happened. And so had the opportunity to dialogue with the superintendent on some of the changes they made at that time. And we have a different way of doing things than you guys are doing in San Bernardino. And I'll be really curious to hear kind of your take on things, because we pretty much rely on local police departments to do a routine patrol of all the schools. And then every high school and middle school has the school resource officer that's assigned by one of the either local municipal departments or one of the county or the county sheriff's department, depending on where they're located. So
let's get an idea. San Bernardino County is like the largest, one of the largest counties in the United States. It is like huge. And it goes on from Lake Tahoe to almost LA. It's like freaking ridiculously crazy big. And so tell me what the school police, what tell me what that is and how that came about.
Oh, definitely, Dean. Of course, one of the oldest school police departments that you'll find in California is LA Unified. And of course, LA Unified is the largest, which spans out of LA. And of course, they're at the front end of the school police movement. So of course, you'll find, for instance, in San Bernardino County, it's about six or seven school police departments that service school districts, right? So of course, under the education code, the school board has the authority to create a police department and or both, a security department and a police department. So of course, for us here at San Bernardino Unified, we're unique that we have both. So you'll find a bicameral department in our district, which is a police department and a security department. And of course, and what's unique about us, and we're a department that's post-certified, right? Which encompasses the entire umbrella. And of course, we're the primary law enforcement entity across the district. You know, earlier you asked me a question in terms of the district, and the district sits across 109 square miles, the district itself, inside of San Bernardino County. We encompass about three cities, right? We do work in three cities. A little under 50,000 students, 8,000 employees, over 83 sites across those 109 square miles. So you're talking 73 schools, as well as admin buildings across the city. And by the way, something exciting for me in terms of a legacy project is that we have a standalone police department being built for this department. So of course, our work enforced the 19 different codes, from the penal code to the vehicle code, health and safety code across the board. However, we do that in conjunction with all the partners right across those cities, which is the municipalities that service those cities. They're good partners with us. So we do this work together.
So let me get this right. You guys are on the forefront of the police school movement that is kind of sweeping across the country, because you are seeing that move across the country, because districts are realizing that the need for police services goes beyond the scope of what normal police departments can do. So give me a little bit of the scope of the duties of, you know, the school district police.
Oh yeah, definitely, Dean. And of course, ours is to ultimately support the educational process, right? Because of course, school district, their business is to educate kids. So of course, we bring down to bear all the resources that's provided for the police department to make sure the kids get educated. And of course, we do that in unique ways in terms of placing police officers on high schools, maybe middle schools, and making sure that elementary schools are supported in that way. All the security needs that they have in terms of technology, we lead that conversation. And also, it may be physical security in terms of fencing, single point entry, any of these conversations like that. We're part of that conversation. Of course, here in California, state law requires a school safety plan be created. And of course, we're a part of that conversation to make sure that we help the approval of the safety plan across the district in terms of being a law enforcement entity that service the district. And of course, MRs also is to create programs such as Explore Auxiliary, the Junior Explore Program, the Traditional Explore Program, Cadet Program, which becomes career pathways for our kids in terms of public safety across the board. So of course, we're part of educating our kids too, in terms of exposing them to the experience in public safety, as far as that education as well.
Well, let me ask you a difference. And this question our audience might be having, what's the difference between an SRO and a school police officer?
Oh, Dean, you're getting to the root of the matter. So an SRO oftentimes is on loan from the municipality to the school district. A school police officer is an employee of the school district. So when you get a school police title, that means most likely that you're an employee of that particular school district that, that you work for.
And so you guys are like, let me see if I parallel this kind of right. It's like, you guys are like university police, kind of the same kind of model made after that.
Oh yeah, definitely. Dean, of course, we have a specific designation in the penal code, right? In California, we fall in A30.32 of the penal code, which designate all those educational entities that support the educational process, K through 12, as well as community colleges. And now when you start talking university policing, they're A30.2 of the penal code because they're a state entity, right? However, we're a special entity and a special district created us. So we get that special district designation in the penal code.
Well, does your authority supersede like on the campus facility? Now, I'm going to get into the Uvalde report in just a minute because there were a number of things in there that were, I think we need to probably just, you know, talk about.
Right.
Because I think one of the things in law enforcement that I see as a major problem across the country is we're a little hesitant sometimes to talk about what other agencies do or what might occur, because certainly reasonable, because we don't know all the circumstances. But there are certain standards of conduct. There are certain standards that we got to hold everybody to. And when it comes to the safety of children's lives, jurisdictional lines should matter, and it should be tactical lines to who can provide the most safety, but it should be decisions are made in the best interest of children's lives, not people's reputations or not people's own personal views or whatever that is, because bottom line is those kids depend on us to be totally safe in their environment. So with that being said, if an incident occurred, who would take precedent at a school building district if, let's say, you had, God forbid, a situation like they had in Uvalde, Texas, and our intent is not to be critical. Our intent is to be proactive in this conversation, to be to the point of how do we move forward. So what would be the boundaries there? Let's say you have a active shooter in, you know, one of your schools. Who does does the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department let y'all handle it, or how does that take over?
Yeah, so of course, it would be a joint incident command, MD. However, resources also dictates that. Second thing that would dictate it is a memorandum of understanding, a MOU, that, for instance, we have with the city of San Bernardino, we have with the county sheriff's office. So it would be MOU dictated. So something like that, in terms of the amount of resources we have, oftentimes we'll probably have them step in and be able to start leading the response to an incident like that. And of course, Dean, is also this deference to knowledge, right? And yeah, I'm not a hostage negotiator. So of course, I would have somebody with that skill and those trained in that technique be able to do that work. However, it's a doctrine, and we could get into this that we've studied for over 30 years in terms of a way that we respond to active killing in any building across our nation. And of course, we know that that wasn't followed when it comes to that incident. So of course, it'll be MOU dictated. It would also be resource dictated. And of course, there may be a joint conversation in terms of the resources that's out there and what do we need from each other to make sure that we're responding appropriately.
Well, both of you and I know that sounds good in the boardroom, but when the shots are being fired, that shit just goes out the window really quickly because you've got an active shooter and you got a lot going on. I'm going to say something here that I want to make sure that I make, you know, really pretty clear. First of all, cops are not cowards. And the men and women who responded to the Uvalde incident are not cowards. Those people put themselves in the direct line of fire. I get that. The kid was in the room, but they were involved in an active shooting incident. I blame leadership because they failed to call the signals that needed to be done to, in order for the response to be the way it was. Now, that was a tough situation. If you watch that video, it's very hard to watch because you know what's going on, and leadership should have taken a much more active role in calling the signals to take this guy out and knock all this bull crap or this nonsense off of barricaded suspect. This kid's in an active shooter situation. And I think if you'll read the report, one of the things that was said was that when that call came about, it was way too early in the situation where there was an active shooter involved in that. So cops across this great nation are not cowards. They are extremely courageous. And I think leadership in this situation should be held accountable for either not making the call or doing what they did. And we'll vet all those things out as the report goes and we find those out. But what struck you, and I know you've read the Uvalde report, what struck you about that report?
Yeah, I think what struck me was, how short it was. And it's a short report for a huge incident, for one. And, my question would be, what's not in the report in terms of information that should be in there? Yeah, Dean, I think it's some areas that there was some serious breakdown in terms of the information that I was able to garner. And one of them was a communication breakdown. In terms of who's in charge. Because if you read that report, it speaks to the Uvalde Police Department being there first, right? And of course, if we're following doctrine, and of course, it speaks to an officer requesting permission to take a shot. It's like all these things, and that becomes an interesting question mark in terms of competence, right? So some competence question that report has really raised for me in terms of, and which had me walk in a brief in my office and say, hey, it's important that you're clear. And that if you believe that people are in danger, that you take action to be able to deal with that.
Right.
You don't need permission to be able to deal with that.
And I thought one of the things that struck me in that report, I think the most damning comment in that report for police across the country is that they cared more about their personal safety than they did the safety of the children. And we've got to answer those questions. We have to find an answer to, you know, why were they running around? There was 350 cops on the scene. Now, not in the hallway, but they've counted. There was 149 Border Patrol agents in the area. And you know as well as I do that there are very significant lines between federal law enforcement and state law enforcement and their ability to act. And, you know, we just need to find, when you've got an active shooter, when you've got a situation that is that dire and that extreme, then we have to worry more about the safety of the victims than we do about the policies. Although we're guided by those and we know those are important, but we've got to figure out a way that, how do you take decisive action and how do we get cops to react and not wait on bosses to tell them things when they know there's a natural reaction that needs to be done. And I mean, when you look at that report, those first guys in the video, they actually take fire and there you can actually see shrapnel or whatever it is from the building or whatever the bullets or whatever is zipping by, and then they retreat. And then I think everybody at that point went into a defensive mode. And that is normal response in a defensive mode. But anybody, and I haven't been in the military, but talking to people about this in the military, when you get into defensive mode, you kind of pull back. When you go on the attack mode, you move forward. And I think when they got on the defensive mode, it slowed things down that really caused a lot of problems. So I don't know what your take on that is, but you know, it appeared to me that we have got to find a way. And we did that initially with police officer training when we started dealing with active shooters, not so much at schools, but active shooters in any place was, you know, we used to wait on SWAT teams to go in and take out people like that. But now we form teams really quickly and, you know, they go out and do it. But in this case, it seems like we went in the defensive posture maybe too quickly, or, you know, certainly the results would say that we did. And even Steve McCraw, who is the, you know, the chief of the Texas DPS, I mean, his point was, well, that decision was probably a failed or faulty decision. So we got to figure out a way when we go on the attack, we might not have all the armament. We might not have all the devices to hide around. We might not have all the ballistic shields. But there comes a point where you got to go in full attack mode. And I think we probably missed the opportunity right there. And then we drew back, and now it becomes a defensive decision, and it should have been an offensive attack decision much earlier.
Yeah, definitely, Dean. I'm right with you. I believe it just sets us back in terms of the way you look at that response. Of course, for years there, we've trained our police officers to go in as soon as they believe that somebody's actively killing them, somebody we're actively shooting up a school or any building. I think you'll find maybe a gap in training that has occurred there, where those entities may not have had a prior conversation. In terms of what would we want to occur if something was to happen. And so, of course, it's a lesson to us in terms of knowing that danger is there. However, opportunity for all of us to do it a lot better, law enforcement across the nation. So, and of course, I'm dissecting it along with my team to make sure that those mistakes we don't make, it may be something different, however, it won't be those. Hey, Dean, let me remind you, it's not just Sam, a couple years ago, we had North Park, and North Park wasn't as heinous as what occurred at Uvalde. But of course, we had a husband that walked in, Karen Smith's husband, into the classroom, execute her, shoot Jonathan Martinez, as well as them. Another student. However, I could say that our system has been tested in terms of our ability to be able to work together as public safety entity in response to active killing on the campus. And of course, prior to that, we had the 14 dead at the RRC. And of course, our organization also responded to that heinous act in terms of terrorism in our community. So, of course, our system has been tested. So, we've learned. We want to make sure that we don't make dire mistakes like that.
Well, and you know, when you look at the tactical nature, I did SWAT for 14 years. And I think one of the mistakes that we as police administrators make sometimes is we do leave those tactical situations to the better trained, the better equipped, the better designed teams, if you will, if you have time to do it. But we're learning. You think about this for a second. Do you realize there's been 350 somewhat active shootings in the United States this year alone? 350. Now, what that is called an active shooter, if it's by the FBI, it's like four or more people are shot. And, a situation like that. You think about it, 350, which means that the numbers are trending upward. And we as police departments and leaders are going to have to start realizing we're going to have to take a more active role in tactically training everybody, not just the SWAT team members, because today's times are certainly, you know, and I wrote an article about the Uvalde shooting. If you haven't had an opportunity to read the article, you can find it on our website on LHLA.org. It's on LinkedIn on the article there. And the one things I said in that was that we ought to create a specific zone around the school system. And when people are actively in shooting, that we lower the threshold of use of deadly force. And that we also increase the ability there for officers to be protected civilly because of the actions they may take. Because we all know that it's more important to save the life of a child at that moment than it is to worry about the judicial issues later. And I know that's true. And it's certainly hard. It's easier to say that than do it. But it is true. Qualified immunity, I recommend that qualified immunity ought to be increased for police officers' actions around the school district. And that when you encounter an active shooter at a school system, the level of use of force is much less. My opinion, you're seen carrying a rifle onto a school ground. If there's an officer who takes you out without asking questions, you know, hey, you got to realize that's a special place around that school district where you carried a long rifle or a gun. You better have a dang good reason to carry one, and you better openly understand you're carrying a long rifle and you ain't got no ID on you and you ain't got nothing that says police and you're just walking around. There's not a lot of time for questions to be asked. And I think that's what Wilna was talking about, was permission to shoot the guy when he was carrying two long rifles after he just wrecked the car. Now, I don't know that to be totally true. I'm saying that was mentioned as, you know, an occurrence there, but we've got the drastic times, take drastic measures. And one of my friends that I love him, he's a sheriff in Brevard County, Florida, and his name's Wayne Ivey. And one of the things he says, which, you know, Wayne's a great sheriff and he does a great job for that community there, is he says, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And, you know, that's true as it gets there. Kelly, you want to chime in for a second?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I'm going to take a little bit different tactic. I don't know anything about the tactics that were used inside the building. I know what I watched. It was troubling. As a parent that didn't have kids, it wasn't that long ago for me that I had children that age that would have been trying to save themselves. But I think what bothers me the most is the fact that the guy even got in the building in the first place. What I do know about school security here in Greenville County is that they go into very strict capture entries once school starts. And there are only limited times during the day that they're allowed to exit those buildings, you know, for recess at the elementary level, things of that nature. And my understanding is, and I may be wrong on this, so please correct me if I am, that school had gone into lockdown when the teacher in question decided to go retrieve something outside that created the point of entry. She thought it had relatched. It didn't. And that's how he got in. Had he never gotten in, we might have had a few people shot through a window, but not 23 people dead. And I guess my question to you as someone that sees school districts all the time is, I want to know how we can harden our schools better. I understand that teachers get desensitized when you have multiple lockdowns in a school year. A lot of them are false alarms. It becomes a crying wolf scenario, if you will. But there's got to be some really hard, I hate to use the word penalties, but consequences if a person who is a employee of the school district violates those rules. And there's just some culpability there that goes beyond. And then on the other side, what I do see just in what I do every day with Dean, and we've talked about this, is the environment for law enforcement has been borderline toxic, you know, from the public and the media for the last several years, that I have to almost wonder, was this just a bad habit, as Dean talks about, that was created, where they were just reluctant to really take action and be proactive? And there's a quote that George Patton used to always use that he's quoted as saying, which is, courage is the most important virtue, because without it, none of the other virtues matter. You can be a good person, you can have the most kind heart, you can do everything, but in that moment, when you can't act with courage, and to Dean's point, I don't look at these guys as cowards, I look at them more as their leaders did not demonstrate that they had the courage to back them up. There was something that fell down there. And that's my two cents worth on it. It's just a shame. I mean, my heart just bleeds for all those families down there and the children that survived. They're going to be forever, and the teachers that survived, they're going to be forever damaged. It's going to be a very long road back.
I want to say a couple of things about that. Just, I think you're, you know, great observations regarding, you know, this situation. I've been in an active firefight. I've been in a active situation where people are actually shooting at you. I've never seen cops not be courageous, and I don't think they were not courageous here, but there's a difference than being courageous and foolish. And you don't just, you know, run straight head on with a guy who's got an AR-15 and, you know, be the first victim, because you're always taught, if you can't stay alive, you can't help us. That's which right. is true. But there comes a time when you're advancing and you get a plan to advance that you realize you may take casualties. And, you know, being a police chief, I've been on the other end of that where, you know, you've had casualties or situations where people have advanced under fire or you being courageous, but they, all of them had a plan forward of what they were trying to do and accomplish. And I think that was a fault here, was that there wasn't, leadership wasn't providing, okay, we're going to go, all right, we're dead full on attack. You cover this side, you cover that side, lay down fire. Here we go. There was, all right, let's back up and see if this guy's going to negotiate. Let's treat it as a barricade. You know what? That guy wasn't interested in negotiations. And, you know, making that call is a tough one. And sitting here, certainly armchair quarterbacking, it's a hell of a lot easier than being on the streets when that occurs. But if those cops, I'm a firm believer, if those cops had had good direction with leadership, they would have went into that situation fully taking fire, fully recognizing collateral damage and consequences that may occur. And there's nobody, in my personal opinion and belief, you can't make me believe any different, any cop in that room right there wouldn't have took that guy out in a second had they had the opportunity to do it and do what they had to do and stop that violence.
Totally.
They would have done it. They would have done it. But,
they
like the plan. They like leadership. They like the full-on commitment. Because when leadership gives you the go, you're covered. You know, and nobody was willing to go in there. Because let's be honest, had they gone in there blistering rounds, they didn't know, they didn't have eyes in there. They didn't know what, they could have shot 4 or 5 kids.
Absolutely.
And we'd be having a total different conversation now. Yeah. Than we're having right now. So let's you know, put that out there and put that in perspective. But to be honest with you, we got to find a way to release these cops to do their job. And whether that's through training, through that's communication, whether that's through figuring out, but this is a tipping point of, we've had enough with these school shootings. We got to make, my title of my article was, we've made the airways safe, so now it's time to make the hallway safe. And
I'll send
kids
you.
Go to school with, and kids expect going to school and coming home at night because they know police will protect them, and we got to fulfill that responsibility there. And I think the most troubling thing for me, Kelly, is like what you said, was that the public perception, then it, when it says you're personal safety took precedent over the safety of the children. Well, that was the end result, but that was the result of lack of plan, lack of leadership, lack of support. There is no cop on that scene. There is no cop on that scene who would have not done what they could have done to save one single kid or a shot being fired. Yeah, I believe that. I mean, that's what cops do. But we got to be smart enough, and we got to be as leaders to say, we got to give you the support. We got to give you the equipment. We got to give you the training. We got to give you all those things to be able to make that decision without waiting on me to tell you what needs to be done. Joe, come on now.
Yeah,
help me out here.
Yeah, you're right on. However, I'll push it a lot further in terms of you need all those things as well as permission. What happens then when you have multiple agencies colliding like that and nobody takes charge? Then you have people just Neanderthal in the wall around and nobody going forward. So of course we need to make sure that young police officers as well as others, sergeants, take charge. And of course, we give them permission to be able to do the work that they need to do. I think you bring up a great point in terms of laws that may be able to support our work further, that solidify where it seems like you could do your work, and guess what? The entire community will support you. The penal code has you, or any different laws across our land will be supportive of our work. I love your idea in terms of a perimeter around our schools that, hey, if you're in this area with a gun, you got issues. Yeah, right.
You're going to get, we're going to shoot before we ask questions. So you come on this school ground with a gun, it ain't no talking.
Definitely. Of course, if that young police officer, I think if he understood, for one, the use of deadly force, right? Deadly force in the environment he was in, and where you have maybe, for instance, in California, we have a Safe School Act, where if you're within a certain number of feet of a school, it's an enhancement to have a weapon in that area if you commit certain crimes in that area as well. And so, of course, it's a competency conversation here as well, Dean, that I think we need to attack in terms of making sure that our young police officers are clear on deadly force, the policy, state law, and where they don't have to guess at it, right? That it's automatic form, especially like you said, with the most vulnerable population, which are our kids, in an environment where they can be picked off by these wolves. So, yeah, I think you're right on. And of course, Kelly's right on in terms of her autopsy. And of course, I'm sure the nation, and when they look at that incident, it's like, like you said, it's over 300 plus every weekend. What is it that we're doing to make sure that we're addressing it properly on the front end, as well as mitigating it on the back end?
Let me say this, Joe, for you. And so before I lose this point, because I'm old and I'll lose stuff. So let me say this while I'm thinking. We've got to look at three things. We've got to harden the physical structure. We've also got to harden our legislation, our laws surrounding our schools, to give cops special permission on perimeters of schools, that the use of force, the policy on encounters, the rules of engagement, those things are supported within that school district. And we got to harden our training. Our hardening of a school facility doesn't just mean hardening the school facility.
Right.
I think what Kelly said made a great point. And I think what she said brings me to this point. The reason those people left that door and they went outside was because they had had 43 incidences. And what had happened is they had gotten soft to the lockdowns. So I think personal responsibility and accountability has to be done, where it's better to have an apology instead of a eulogy. So when it comes to locking a door down, if somebody has to be inconvenienced and they're just taking it lightly and you have to walk all the way up in it, so what? You got to say, that's the way it is, and that's the way it is, because we take it too casually. And I think that, I'm advocating we harden our laws, we harden our procedures, our tactics, our training, and our facilities. It's not just hardening the school facility. that's going to matter. So, I mean, that's my two cents with that. Kelly, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, no, that's fine. It actually dovetailed on what I was going to say. I mean, right here in Greenville County, we had a shooting back in the spring before this at a middle school where a young man, it was gang related, they're pretty sure. And it was two 12-year-olds, actually, seventh graders. One had a beef with the other kid, walks in at lunchtime with a handgun. And it was an assassination killing, literally, on this other kid. Happened in the hallways of a middle school. And so it set off a pretty big conversation within the area about what are we going to do? You know, what are we doing to really make this secure? And it's a logistical nightmare. You probably see it in a district as large as San Bernardino. You're dealing with 48 schools, which includes 18 to 20 high schools, another, you know, 30 to 40 middle schools, and then you got all the elementary schools. And we started the whole capture entrance process after Sandy Hook, which to your point is you can't open exterior doors unless there's certain times a day that the principal knows it's happening. Everybody's agreed to that's when we're going out for recess. That's when we're doing different things. But when that lockdown is called by the administrator, there's no door that's opening and shouldn't open. And to Dean's point, that's where the, you know, I think that's still a question in my mind is how do we help those teachers and those administrators not get desensitized, number one. And then as we work on those school safety plans, and I've been tangentially related to some of those being on, you know, school improvement councils and things of that nature, where are we really doing what we need to do to save the kids once an active shooter is in place? If you've identified where that active shooter is in the building, what's the plan to get the other kids out, just to get them out of the out of any possible way? So those are the kind of things that I still think need to have that dialogue.
But, you know, the interesting thing is that we've already proven what happens if we don't do the right thing. We definitely don't want that to happen again. And I think there is no one answer. There's a lot of it there. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on with this school system thing, but I think we have got to make sure, like I said, we've made the airways safe. We've got to make the hallways safe. And when you do that, you do what you got to do. So Joe, I'm going to give you some closing thoughts here on your perspective on what's going on with the school district stuff. And what a pleasure to have you on here to add an expert on school safety. And I don't think there's many podcasts or shows that had the school district. I think people are afraid to talk about that issue. They're not doing it. So, but on Straight Talk, that's what we're about. We're talking about Straight Talk, man. Let's hear what we think. And our, you know, what we say, we're not asking everybody to agree with. We're just saying, if I can get you to start the discussion and move it forward on our school safety, then we've done exactly what we wanted to do. We're not trying to be perfect.
And
we just got to be better.
From different parts of the country. So,
well, remember, school safety doesn't. Well, school safety, you know, we want to make it the best it can absolutely be. This is ridiculous. So, Joe, tell me something here, some good thoughts here as we close this podcast out.
Yeah, definitely, Dana. And of course, this man, definitely, a well-spent hour. I gave 15 minutes more to Kelly than you. However, I still owe you lunch, my brother. You know, I think I'm in the spirit of your language when it comes to facility. We need to continue making sure that we pitch technology as a force multiplier across the board, camera systems to be able to tell us how we can do things better. Single point entry, Dean, and locking mechanisms that allows our door to self-initiate and to let us know that they're ajar, right? Things like that we leverage.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, in terms of camera system analytics that speaks to bad people being in the areas of our schools that helps us be able to identify them. And of course, your work in terms of making sure we continue to encourage people to arrive at a place of leadership where they lead from a place of learning. You know, I've been studying because this, I was telling you, I was facilitating today, I mean, it was active shooter, and believe it or not, you know, for one of our local charter schools, which is a rise in terms of the request to be able to do that. However, I was sharing with the administrator that they can do it. They don't need law enforcement to come in to do it for them. They can practice the response to active armed intruders across the board without law enforcement. However, they need law enforcement to come in to tell them how they would respond to it. So, of course, we need to make sure that we stay proactive in making sure that people are armed with the most latest of information that's out there. We want them informed. Informed systems are safer systems. And then, of course, we need to encourage school districts across our nation. If you have a procedure, make sure you follow it. Don't be propping doors open, and make sure that you pay attention at the active shooter training. And if you need to run, make sure that that's the first choice. And of course, if you need to lock down, that you know how to go about doing it. And of course, if we need to fight, that we fight to the death. And because our children is important. Dean, thanks for your time. Thanks for having me. You know, appreciate you, my brother.
Joe, thank you. So let's, Joe, how can people contact you if they wanted had more questions? Because we might have some people out there that are interested in your expertise, and you're one of those folks who give your time very freely to people to try to help them. So how would they do that? How would they contact you?
Yeah, definitely. Dean, of course, I can be reached via my office, air code 909-388-6033. And of course, my assistant, her name is Atsidi Landeros. And of course, you can also email me, joseph.polino@sbcusd.com. And of course, my cell phone, which is the bat line, area code 909-240-3328.
Well, folks, it don't get any better than that to have at your access a absolute school security expert and professional who does it every single day. And he's just said he's willing to help you any way you can. Joe, what a pleasure. Kelly, thank you so much as always being on the podcast and producing it. And Joe is a great advocate also of leadership. He can help you in a lot of ways. So please use him. Thank you for the courage to get on here and talk about school safety and the Uvalde shooting. And you know what? As we always say on here, until next time, I'm Dean Crisp.
You have been listening to Straight Talk on Leadership with Dean Crisp. Thank you for listening. At LHLN, we truly believe that leadership is simple, but we know it isn't easy. We encourage you to check out our live leadership development classes at our website, www.lhln.org, where you can request a class or sign up for one in your area. Another great opportunity to learn from Dean is to dive into his book, Essential Leadership Lessons from the Thin Blue Line. It's available on all bookseller platforms and offers excellent tips on leading yourself, leading others, and leading the organization. Until next time, remember to put your leadership into action by growing yourself and others every day.